Okay, everyone. Hi there. Thanks for coming. My name's Lucian Wishick. I'm a program manager on the VB C# language design teams. I've spent the past 3 years, 4 years of my life working on async, and the past year of it studying how people are using async, what are the common pitfalls they've been falling into, and where they need guidance. And that's what this talk really is. It's all about giving guidance on best practices, on how to use async and avoid the common pitfalls. Just before I start, I'd really appreciate it if you like this talk, please fill out an evaluation form. If you don't like this talk, please fill out an evaluation form because I deserve to be told. It's the evaluation forms that let me keep coming to tech eds in future. There are three key takeaways from this talk. If you go away remembering nothing apart from these three sentences, I'll be very happy. Async void is for top-level event handlers only. You can use async tasks to wrap around events to make your code simpler. And you should use the thread pool for CPU-bound work, but not for IO-bound work. Those are the three key messages. And the talk's just going to be split into three sections, one, two, three, to flesh out the details and the implications and the practical ramifications of each of the three takeaways. Just a question. How many of you have been using async for a while? And keep your hand up if you feel you're using it properly and you're confident you understand how it works. That's quite a lot fewer. I think because of that, it was really important to just start with a brief 5 minutes to spell out exactly what happens to the control flow in an async method. I believe that if you understand what's happening in these diagrams for the next 5 minutes, you'll be able to predict the next 75 minutes of the talk. Heck, even if you don't understand, you'll still be able to get the rest of the talk. But this is what async should be like in the ideal world. It really is as simple as this. As the message loop, the user hits the button click, let's say, it fires, or the UI message pump fires the event handler, and here it to invoke this async method, load settings async, which returns a task. And then control flow gets to the first await inside an async method. At the first await inside an async method, it creates a task object on the heap if it was task returning, and then it returns back to its caller. We're here. This method has just reached the first await of an async method. It happened to be a void returning method, so it didn't need to create any tasks. But then, at the first await of the method, it returns to its caller. And because it's returned to its caller, the message pump is free to deal with further messages as they arise. And that's what keeps our apps responsive when we use async. Later on, this download that we kicked off will finish 3 seconds later, 10 seconds later if you're at tech ed and internet Wi-Fi isn't very good. And that task gets marked as completed. What does it mean when a task gets marked as completed that's been awaited? Well, it means that the task gets moved somewhere so that the message loop, when it's free to do its work, when it's free to pick up completed tasks, can go straight back to where the await left off, and it can continue from that point. What's it going to do when it continues from this point? Well, the only work left to do is the closing brace of this method. All it's got to do is to complete this method. When you complete an async task returning method, it marks that task as being completed. Well, it marks the task as being completed and it returns back to the message loop. So the message loop is free to do more work. And the work that it will do is it will pick up the next task that's been completed that was being awaited, and it will jump up to resume where the await left off. What's it going to do at this point? Well, it's just going to do the remainder of the work and resume back pumping messages. That, in a nutshell, is all that async is about. As I said, if you followed that diagram, you'll predict the next 75 minutes. If you didn't follow it, well, the next 75 minutes will still make sense. Let's get on to the first of the three sections of this talk. This section is Async Void is only for event handlers. I actually, in all of this talk, every section is motivated by user stories, people where I've seen user complaints or heard them or read them on the forums. And this user, it was doing a Silverlight application. She'd seen Windows 8. She really liked the swipe panel from the side. She wanted to create the same effect in her Silverlight app. It was a forms over data app. And she was struggling to implement the print button effectively. I'll read to you exactly what she said. She said, I have a Silverlight page that uses RIA services async to load the data for the page. This works fine, she said, if the user waits for a few seconds before hitting the print button. But it does not work if the user prints right away. If the user clicks the print button before all the page data is loaded, the printed output does not have all of the data. I read that. I heard the phrase, it doesn't always work reliably. I first guess was that she was using async void somewhere deep inside her code, and the fix she should have done was to make the async method task returning, not void returning. For goodness sake, stop using async voids everywhere. That was going to be the title of this entire talk, but they talked me down from that. You know, the forms over data application, it was a really good example, but it wasn't concise enough for me to fit into a tech ed talk. So here I picked up a different example I'd found from a different user. They had exactly the same problem. They had bugs in their code because deep inside their code, they had a void returning async instead of a task returning async. Actually, this code came from one of the official Windows 8 SDK samples. Just goes to show that everyone can make this mistake and that everyone does make this mistake. Don't worry, they've fixed up the Windows 8 SDK by now. So what happens? Whoops. Here, the user clicks a button. It enters the click handler. It invokes this method, send data. So control flow transfers into the send data method. It does some synchronous stuff, creating this web request. And then it comes to an await statement. What does an await statement do? Well, this one happens to be void returning, so it doesn't need to construct a task. But at the first await of a method, control returns back to the caller. Here, at the caller, there was an await task.delay of 2,000. At the first await of this method, control flow returns back to its caller, to the UI message pump, in fact. And what happens next? Well, we have two tasks running. One of them is await task.delay of 2 seconds. The other is await request.getResponse async. One of them will complete next. Well, both of them will complete, but we don't know which order they'll complete. We don't know if the delay will complete first, or if this will complete first, and assign to the field m.getResponse in time for this guy to use it. This is a race condition. Question, why were they using task.delay of 2,000? I can tell you why. At first, I bet they didn't have the task.delay, and m.getResponse was never ready. So they put in a task.delay. They tried 500. It wasn't quick enough. They tried 2,000. It was working quick enough on their internal Microsoft CorpNet network that they felt happy. But again, when they came to the worldwide or an airport internet, slow connectivity, it wasn't enough, and people start getting errors. So what's the problem? The problem is that they returned void from this method. They should have returned task. The problem is that they returned void. And that meant that this guy was unable to know when this method had finished. He was unable to await for it. That's the source of all this problem. And the fix is straightforward. The fix is that he should have put a task returning thing in there. That's just one of the two problems with async void returning methods. And before fixing it up, I want to tell you what the other one. Let's comment out the problematic race condition. So we're not using the variable mGetResponse anymore. We've avoided that race condition. The next problem with async voids is exceptions. What happens in this control flow? As again, the user clicks on the button, it invokes send data, it comes down here, it comes to the await statement. It's making a web request, right? A web request might succeed or it might fail. We don't know immediately. We'll know in 4 seconds whether it got a 404 error or a timeout or whether it succeeded. So the exception we get is only going to arise when we resume from the await. We haven't yet. We just reached the first await, and at the first await of the method, we return back to the caller. We return back to the caller, and we plow straight on through the catch exception handler block. The exception has not been thrown yet. That's going to happen 4 seconds later. So this, sure as anything, is not going to catch the exception. Question, what is going to happen to the exception if it wasn't going to be caught by this? Well, the answer is, it's going to post the exception to the UI thread as an unhandled exception. In a Windows phone, that will be swallowed silently. In Windows 8, it will crash the application. In WPF, it will pop up a dialog box. In all cases, that's not the good behavior, is it? So, all of these, both of these problems, they boil down to the fact that async void is inherently a fire and forget mechanism. By fire and forget, I mean the caller is unable to know when the method is finished, is unable to catch any exceptions. It is only appropriate to be used in fire and forget scenarios, and this send data was sure as anything not. So let's recap what we've said. What we said is that async void is a fire and forget mechanism. Caller is unable to know when it's finished, and the guidance is to use async void only for top-level event handlers or things like them. I'll tell you what I mean by things like them later. And everywhere else, your async method should be returning task or task of T. There's one other part to this, which is to do with async lambdas and whether they're void returning or task returning. That's a bit subtle, so I'll return to that later. But before that, let's fix up the user's code. They should have returned task. The convention is whenever we have an async method that's task returning, it should have the name async at the end. So when he's calling send data async, the compiler will usually warn him. It's saying, warning, you're invoking an async method without the await operator, and so you'll put the await operator in. That sounded easy enough, but the reality is it's not always that easy. Here's a case where it isn't as easy. Why I actually started with this was I wanted to know just how much of a problem is async void. I went to the MSDN forums in Stack Overflow, and I did a search for the phrase async void and problems. This was the number one result I got back, something called load state. I'd never heard about it before. It turns out it's a Windows 8 thing to do with the Windows 8 page navigation model. So what happens on Windows 8 is when you navigate to a page, anytime you navigate to a page, it fires an navigated to event handler. And the base class for every page has a virtual void method which handles that event, and everyone overrides that virtual void method. Here, I'm overriding the void unnavigated to method. And because this is firing in response to an event, it really is a fire and forget scenario, isn't it? So it's a legitimate use of async void here. Well, first thing we do is invoke base.unnavigated to. I had no idea what this did. I looked up the source code in the template. Here's the source for the base thing. The base implementation of unnavigated to says, if the page has already been visited, then return immediately. But if this is the first time that the page has been navigated to since it was constructed, then invoke this virtual void load state method. Virtual void load state, it's feeling quite a lot like a fire and forget scenario as well. It's just fired and forgetted by the system whenever we navigate to a page for the first time. So that's why they, in the templates, they thought it was legitimately an async void scenario. Actually, they just made it a void scenario. It's users who are putting async into it because they wanted to put await in. Anyway, in this case, what am I doing? I'm doing some work to load up a bitmap and store it inside a class level field. Question, how does this code behave? By this stage, it should be looking fairly familiar. But let's step through in detail just to be absolutely sure. The user navigates to the page. It fires an event. That invokes the virtual void onNavigatedTo method that we've overridden. The first thing we do is call base.onNavigatedTo. That, through some work, transfers control flow to our async void load state method, who comes to the first await in him. What happens at the first await of a method? We return back to our caller. What happens at the first await in there? He was doing some other work to play an intro sound. At the first await, he returned back to his caller, to the UI message loop, so he could stay responsive. What happens next depends on which of the two finished first. It's a race condition, as we saw. Now, the answer we had last time was turn this into a task returning load state async, and we can't do it this time. Why can't we do it? Because this isn't under our control. We've done an override void method. Someone else committed us to being a void returning async, so that's out of our control. But we're still going to have to return a task somehow. How are we going to do that? A little bit convoluted, but here's how you do it. I'm going to have the task as a field inside my object. Load state is still void returning, and it invokes load bitmap async, this async task returning helper, but it does not invoke it fire and forget. Oh no. It does not forget the returned task it got back, and it's not a void returning async that it invoked. Instead, it saves that task into a field. And what that means is that later on, this main method can await until that field has finished. I wonder if any of you look at this and wonder if there's a race condition. Like, you might ask, what happens if we get here before the field mBitmap task has been assigned? That would be a good question, but it never happens. And the reason it never happens is that here we invoke base.unnavigatedTo synchronously, which invoked this load state synchronously, so it assigns to mBitmap task before it returned, before control flow returned back here. And even in asynchronous methods, it still executes the first part of it synchronously up until the first await. So this kind of pattern is safe, and we can use it quite widely. There's a lot more to say about async voids. You might be thinking, oh, constructors are kind of like async voids. What do I do for that? Or property setters, they're basically void returning. Can I use async in those? Or property getters, how can I use await inside those? Or I don't know, there were a bunch of questions. I didn't want to derail the talk because we've only got 75 minutes. There is a more advanced talk on async that I'm giving tomorrow afternoon, which is geared more towards library developers. But if you want to drill more into these questions, you can look at the slides. They're all included as hidden slides in the slide deck. It should be available on the Tech Ed website, and also I have them online on my website. I said I'd talk about async void async void lambdas. These get kind of subtle. Look at this. I've written two async lambdas. The first one I assigned to a void returning action, and the second one I assigned to a task returning function delegate. So, one of them is going to be a void returning async, and then the next one is going to be a task returning async. And the subtle thing is that exactly the same syntax of lambda can mean either of them. Here, look at this one. Await task.run of async something or other. This is exactly the same lambda as I wrote up here. Which one is that going to be? Is that going to be the void returning one or the task returning one? It's a difficult question. And the rules in C# for overload resolution are very complicated. The summary of them is that if you invoke an API which offers both overloads, then it will pick the task returning one, and that's good. If you invoked an API which only offered the action delegate, the void returning delegate, then of course it would pick the void returning async and would run into all the same kinds of troubles as we had before. I'm going to show you a practical example of those troubles that people run into. Before that, I want to tell the situation with VB. It's kind of similar but slightly different. In VB, the lambda expression itself determines if it's going to be void returning sub like this or a task returning function like this. But, long story short, the rules, the guidelines are the same. When we invoke a method, if there are both overloads offered, then it will pick the correct one and do what we want. So in general, if we have methods that offer both overloads, we know that we're safe. What happens if methods don't offer both overloads? Well, here's an example that I found people running into quite a lot. This was code running in a Windows 8 app from a background thread, but exactly the same story happens from WPF, Silverlight, Windows Phone, any UI client technology. You're running from a background thread, so you're not allowed to manipulate the UI from the background thread and stuff like that. And so very often the background thread wants to just foray into the UI thread to do some work. And it does that with dispatcher.runAsync. Dispatcher.runAsync will cause this lambda to run on the UI thread. And so often happens, you start writing the lambda, you realize that you're invoking an API that's asynchronous, so you need an await in it, so you need to make it an asynchronous lambda for whatever reason. Well, what happens here? Does dispatcher.runAsync take both overloads? I have no idea. I've never used dispatcher.runAsync in my life before. So hit F12 on it, go to definition, see what it is. I wrote out the definition down here. It takes dispatched handler for its delegate type. Never heard of that. Look it up. It's a delegate void dispatch handler. Uh-oh, warning bells going off. Actually, my warning bells went off much earlier. Whenever I see an async lambda in code, then my warning bells go off, and then I jolly well go and verify what the method I'm passing to is doing. Does it take task returning, or does it only take void returning? I happen to know task.run off by heart because it works well. Everything else I'm checking manually. So what's wrong with this? Let's step through exactly the same diagrams as we were doing before. We invoke this on the UI thread. It starts running the lambda. It comes to the first await in the async lambda. What happens at the first await? It returns to its caller. And so, because it returns to its caller, dispatch.runAsync thinks that the lambda has finished. It doesn't know any better. So the await that was awaiting it thinks that it's finished, and so it resumes, plows straight through the exception block. Maybe it uses the mResult field if needed. Later on, the loading finishes, the lambda resumes, assigns to the mResult field, maybe it throws an exception, and we run into exactly the same two problems we had before with fire and forget async voids. What have we said? We've said async void is a fire and forget mechanism. The caller is unable to know when it's finished. The caller is unable to handle exceptions that came from it. And so the guidance is only use async void for top-level event handlers or things like them, like we saw with async void load state. Also, with a lot of plugin architectures, you'll be implementing an interface with a void returning method, which feels in some sense like a top level event handler. There you're going to have to use async void usually. Everywhere else, your async method should be returning task. Some people ask me sometimes, look, I've done what you said. I made all the rest of my methods return task, but now I really want to invoke one, fire and forget. I'm getting the task back, but I know, because he promised me, that it will never throw an exception, and I know that I never need to do anything once it's finished. What should I do? Because if you just invoke a task returning async method, the compiler warns you, hey, you should be awaiting it. Well, practice in this case, I always write an extension method called fire and forget, and so I do fred async dot fire and forget. It's an extension method on task. And that way, anyone who's reading my code knows very clearly my intentions, that I knew that it was an asynchronous task, that I knew and I was promising that it was not going to fire any exceptions, that I would never care when it finishes. And maybe inside my fire and forget extension method, I'm catching any exceptions that it throws and writing them to a log because something seriously has gone wrong. And the other guidance I told you, watch out for those async lambdas. Whenever you see async lambda, validate it. Okay, that's the end of the first part of the talk. This example actually comes from exactly the same customer as the first one. Basically, the diagnostic, if a user says my UI code looks like spaghetti, events are probably the problem. And the answer is that we can use async, await, and tasks to wrap the events to make the code much easier to write. Let's see what she actually said for her application, this forms over data. She said, I have a Silverlight page that uses Rio services async to load the data for the page. She said, it fires an uncompleted method when the load is complete. If the user clicks the print button before all of the page data is loaded, the printed output does not have all the data. And then she asked, really good question, can I use await in some way to wait for the completed event? You know, forms over data doesn't make for very compelling demos. Even though she had a fantastic UI, it really looked smooth and people liked it. I'm going to walk through the code of a different customer. His code was awful. It was like spaghetti. He had lost the ability to add or maintain features in his code, and he had exactly the same trouble with it. The problem, again, that he was building a complicated UI around events, and the fix, again, was to wrap those events inside task so that he could await them, and that would clean up his code. Let me just switch to... I don't want to switch yet. I want to show you what his thing looked like. It all started with this. He was building an educational game for four-year-olds to help them learn letters and numbers. He wanted to have an apple tree. It was touch-friendly on phone or Surface, and they could drag the apples, and it would count with them as they counted apples one by one. So it wanted to look something like this. Let's switch to the code. I got married in August last year. That's my wedding photo. It was very exciting. Did the sound come out there? I don't know. This was the game, and they count it as the apples drip into the basket. They do one apple. Ha, 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 ha. It was a bit like Sesame Street. He didn't yet hire the voice actor, so I'm filling in for the voice acting. Two apples. Ha, 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 ha. Three apples. Four. Five. Five, six, seven.
Meep, meep.
Actually, he'd said, we're picking apples and put them into a basket. I think he missed the point that it was meant to be an apple basket, not a shopping basket. You can see that there's some animation when they all come in and a sound effect playing. And actually, if I resume the game from where I left off, it kind of wobbles them. That's, on this level, you can see where the apples are, but it was a bit like Where's Waldo? I don't know if you've read those books, but for 4 or 5 year olds, there were pear trees, fig trees, and sometimes the fruit would be hiding behind branches. And he wanted to just help them figure out where the apples are without being frustrating. That was what he was aiming for. This is the code he had when he showed me. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to understand it. It is a bit complicated. Don't worry, he didn't understand it either. I didn't understand it either. What you can see is that there are lambdas within lambdas within lambdas. Sometimes he was assigning lambdas to fields so that they could be used later. He had lost the ability to know what code was executing at any moment in time or to know why it was executing. He had lost the ability to maintain it, to add new features, to fix bugs, to audit it. So when I came to this, I said, look, we can't do anything with this. Let's start from scratch. Let's figure out a clean architecture for this program. Clean architecture meant drawing a state machine diagram for how it behaves. So when the program starts, I drew this small black square. The black square represent code that is actually executing, that does work. The work it's doing is just initializing everything, kicking off the animations, and then it's sitting around waiting. Remember the apples? They dropped into the tree. It's waiting until both the animation and the sound effect have finished. Once both of their completed events have fired, it can progress onto the next state. Here it does a bit of work to initialize the game, to initialize the game state, and then it enters a state called stable. And in that state, when you hit the press button, it enters another state called dragging, where it does some work. It can respond to the mood and... You know where this is going? This is not the right way to program this either. I mean, we started with spaghetti code and we ended up with an unmaintainable state machine diagram that we actually can't figure out. The problem is events. What I think happened is that he tried to keep everything local with his lambdas, because the event handler, by declaring it as a lambda, it was local to the code he was writing. When we tried to start from scratch, we ended up too global. And you know what kills me, actually? This was crazy. The thing about this diagram, this architecture diagram, is that the piece of work that's actually happening, that my code is made up of, is limited to just these small little black squares. That is, this architecture diagram is no longer saying what my code does. It's instead focused solely on when it does it. That's a mistake. And the problem is events. Events are not going away. Events have been with us always. They're going to be with us for a long time to come. And our task as developers is to learn how to tame those events. And that's where we're going to use wrapping them up in tasks and awaiting them to do that. This actually is the architecture diagram I'd ideally like to draw. Let's step through the architecture. I don't want to have so many states in my state diagram. I want to have only one state in my state diagram. And it responds to three messages: on start, on resume, on pressed. Let's walk through the on pressed. First thing, number one, when it's pressed, we will drag the apple until the press is released. Then we will animate it when it gets close enough to the basket. We'll animate it with a whoosh noise into the basket. Then, if it was the last apple remaining, we'll play the victory sound and whoosh the basket off to the side of the screen. Then we'll wait for a click to happen. If the user clicked play again, then we'll start off from the beginning. This is a very nice architecture diagram because it captures what I want my code to do. Before going into the code for it, let's just review what we've said. We've said that callback programming is hard because of events. If the event handlers are largely independent and not tied together, then it's fine doing them as traditional event handlers. But when they start tying together and having one event after the other, and if your code starts to look like a state machine, or if it started to look like spaghetti, that is the time when you look into wrapping your events with tasks and awaiting them. And the way we're going to wrap them into tasks is use this type called task completion source. That's a type for generating tasks. And we'll see the code to do that in a sec. But before doing that, I want to show you what we did, what the result was of following that advice. This is the code for the on-pressed event handler. And reading through this code, It has successfully, almost line for line, implemented the ideal architecture diagram that we wanted. Number one, when the pointer is being pressed, we let the user drag the apple. Drag async is a helper method that I wrote. When that's done, if it didn't land in the basket, just return. If it did land in the basket, then do the animation to whoosh it into the basket. Storyboard.playAsync is another helper method that I wrote, and we'll be looking through the source code of that. Next, if there were more apples returning remain, otherwise show the victory screen, wait for it to appear, then wait for a button to be clicked. Button.whenClicked is another helper method that I wrote, and we'll look at that. We have implemented line for line the ideal architecture thanks to the trick of wrapping events into tasks. So, how do we do that? It's easy to know the previous slide. How do we actually make it so we can do something like storyboard.wait, await storyboard.playAsync? This was the code. All of his example was in VB, but I suspect most of you are C-sharp developers, so they're complicated concepts. I just wanted to only learn one thing at a time. Let's not learn VB at the same time. This is the C-sharp version of the code. It is subtle. I'm not going to expect you to understand it completely the first time around, but I'm going to walk through it very carefully. What happens? The usage we want to support from our extension method is the user should be able to write await storyboard.playAsync. Storyboard doesn't offer that method. Storyboard only has events, completed events and other events for when it's finished. So we're going to have to handle the events. This is how we do it. So what happens when the user does await storyboard.playAsync? Well, the first thing it does, of course, is invoke this extension playAsync method, this task returning extension method. And the first thing it does is do var tcs equals new task completion source, creating a new one of these task completion sources. A task completion source is like a factory for creating and controlling a single task object, nothing more. That's all it does. Next thing we're going to do is define this lambda. This lambda is going to be invoked when the storyboard fires its onCompleted event, because I sign it up here, storyboard.completed plus equals lambda. We'll look at the contents of it in a moment. But the next line of code we execute, storyboard.begin, is going to kick off the storyboard. Next line of code, await tcs.task. tcs.task is the task that my task completion source has generated for me. Question, has this task completed yet? Heck no, all I did was create it. A task is an object that can exist in two states, either not yet completed or completed. That's all there is. There's nothing inherent in task object about background threads, nothing at all. All it is a passive object that can be in one of these two states. And task completion source is the way to turn it from being one state into another state. Task completion source is the way to turn its task from one state into another. So we've returned back to the user, back to the UI thread, it's been responsive. A few seconds later, the storyboard finishes. The storyboard fires the completed event that we signed up for it, and so it invokes this lambda. When it invokes the lambda, it does this tcs.trySetResult. What that does is it causes the task that we'd created earlier to transition into its completed state. And what that means is that anyone who signed up to be notified when the task had finished, or anyone who awaited it, will then be able to resume. So that will allow anyone who signed up to resume, but before they do, this code's going to finish, unhook the lambda that we signed up. Okay, that was fairly subtle. As I said, I don't expect you to understand it the first time you see it. I do expect to see you understand it the second time you see it. Here's the second time. The syntax that we used in the same example was await button.whenClicked, because we wanted to turn the button.click event into something awaitable. How did we do that? Exactly the same technique. We created a new task completion source. By the way, I'm using task completion source of object. That generates a task of object. Could have been task completion source of int to generate a task of int. If you want to generate a plain old non-generic task, because I wanted to return a task, there is no corresponding task completion source. So I'm just doing a more derived type of object, and I'm ignoring the facts, because a task completion source of object inherits from task. So that will work. Anyway, creating the TCS, defining the lambda, signing up the lambda, awaiting until the thing is finished. Do I have this? Yeah. Awaiting until it's finished. At that point, it returns to the caller. The caller becomes responsive. A few seconds later, the button click happens. It fires the click handler. That's my lambda. This lambda transitions the TCS into the completed state. So anyone who was awaiting on my task will be able to resume. And then it unhooks the lambda. By the way, I'm putting this unhook inside a finally block because I sure as anything want it to be unhooked. I don't want to waste memory by leaving the lambda signed up for too long. There's more of it to say, of course. Again, the slide deck has background slides that go into more detail, like how did I write the drag async helper? It didn't have to just wrap up one event. It had to wrap up two events, the dragged and the released event, into a task returning thing. Earlier, we talked about the danger that dispatcher.run async only takes a void returning lambda. How do we make a more sophisticated version of dispatcher.run, which can also accept a task which has an overload that takes a task returning lambda? Well, we do it using exactly the same task completion source technique. So task completion source technique is a very valuable, very flexible technique they'll be using all over the place to deal with APIs that someone else wrote that aren't yet await friendly, to turn them into await friendly APIs. How do I implement that on resume in the game so that when you resume the game, it jiggles, but it only jiggles until the sound is finished? All of those are background slides in the slide deck. But the principles of what I wrote are straightforward. Callback handling is hard with events is hard. Actually, some of you might be thinking I pulled a bait and switch. I said events are hard because you do these lambdas, these callbacks, and you end up with spaghetti code. But then, I just showed you two slides of code with lambdas and events. Am I trying to pull the wool over your eyes? Well, no, not really. The reason is that when we wrote those short things that wrapped the event into a task, they were 9 lines of code each. They were very small, very easy to audit, very sure to make sure they're correct. And what's more, they were reusable. So the expert in my team can be the what guy who writes these wrappers to turn events into tasks, or I can download NuGet packages. There are some, I forget its name, I'm afraid, which do exactly the same thing. But then the rest of my code is free of callbacks and spaghettis and lambdas. And that's what we've achieved. And when should we know to start using this pattern? Whenever our code is starting to look like spaghetti with nested lambdas, or when it's starting to look like a global state machine. Those are the triggers that you look at and you think, I need to do something different here. And the important thing to take away here is using task completion source as that versatile mechanism. The final of the three sessions, of the three sections. In this one, I wanted to talk about threads and data binding, about IO-bound and CPU-bound work. A user asked, how do I parallelize my code? Long story short, he was asking, he had misunderstood his code. He was thinking if he was thinking of his code as if it was CPU bound, but in fact it was I/O bound. And so the techniques he was using were inappropriate, and he should have been using await, not parallel for. Let's step in detail into his code. He was writing, it was a bit like Zillow.com, a website for when you're buying a house, you want to look at real estate and find out what houses are available, do searches. It looked something like this. I'll tell you what he wrote on the forum post he posted. He said, "I'm now looking at the biggest user complaint about a slow-running operation in an ASP.NET web forms page. Essentially, the page loads some data, and I'm wondering if it would be the best approach to use the task parallel library." Good question. "The method itself deserializes an object, and depending on user choice, it can call the method in a for each 26 or more times, the results of which I bind to a grid panel. The deserialization itself is where 99% of the time is being spent." Well, that's brilliant. He was profiling his application. I'm really happy about that. First step, profile your application, discover where the bottleneck is. The punchline, as I said, is that his code turned out to be CPU bound, I/O bound, not CPU bound, and so he should have been using await. Let's look at what his code actually had. He was going to do load houses sequentially, bind it to a table, and that was the data binding he did for his ASP page, and load houses sequentially. It went one by one through the house. For each of the house, it deserialized, it added to the list, and it returned the list so it could be data bound. Very straightforward code. Sorry, I'm having trouble with my pointer. This is what happened. A request comes into his website. It does the work for the first one, then the work for the second, then for the third, fourth, fifth. If there were five houses, and if each house took 100 milliseconds to deserialize, he'll be taking 500 milliseconds total until the user's page is rendered. Time to first byte. That's until the first bytes start arriving back in the user's browser. So he said, "Should I be using the task parallel library to parallelize it to make it quicker?" So he used parallel.for. It takes the first and the last, and then this lambda, and it will do all of them and then return the list. How does parallel.for work? Well, he did parallel.for, and he passed this lambda to it. So that means that ultimately, five copies of the lambda are going to be executed, one for each house. And the task parallel library basically puts those five copies of the lambda inside a bin waiting to be executed. Actually, it's smarter than that. It creates them gradually as needed. But for purposes of this, let's just think that there are going to be five lambdas which we have to execute. Well, my laptop has two cores in it, a boy and a girl core. You can tell from the colors. And the task parallel library is going to use as many cores as is optimal. It's gradually going to figure out what is the optimal number of cores to, of threads in the thread pool to use. The optimal number is usually as many threads as you have cores, because if you had more threads than cores, some of the threads will just be idle and there was no point. And in this case, suppose it created, it used two threads from the thread pool, the boy and the girl, and they execute them. And this way, it's doing them in parallel, one after the other, and it can get a response out in 300 milliseconds. So that's an improvement. That's doing something better than the 500 milliseconds. But, hold on just one second. What the heck kind of deserialization takes 100 milliseconds? That's an eternity. No one's going to write code just to deserialize one house that takes 100 milliseconds. We dug into it. What his deserialization actually meant was going to the database over the network to download, to fetch the house data from the database. It was not CPU bound at all. It was I/O bound. So whenever we're looking at this, be very conscious. Is our work CPU bound or I/O bound? In his case, it was I/O bound. So what he was actually doing Let's look at his original sequential code. This is what it looked like. First, he kicked off a request to the database. Then he sat there twiddling his thumbs, doing nothing until 100 milliseconds the answer came back. And he did a small amount of work, 1 millisecond to process it. After that, he kicked off the next request, twiddled his thumbs for 100 milliseconds, blah, blah, blah. So it was taking 500 milliseconds, of which 499 milliseconds was just spent twiddling his thumbs, doing nothing useful. What happened with parallel.4? Well, here it gets interesting. The task parallel library, again, it started with two threads in its thread pool because it knows there are two cores. So it's a pretty good guess for the thread pool that two threads will be the right number. And it runs them both, and it kicks them two requests off at the same time. And now it has two threads blocked, doing nothing, twiddling their thumbs. And it knows that now the physical laptop or the physical computer has two cores, but they're not being used for anything. They are now idle cores. And it figures out that it could get more optimal performance by injecting a new thread into the thread pool. So it creates a new thread. It will start with the next item of work, kick off its request. Maybe it will have time to create another thread on the thread pool, the fourth thread, kick off its time. I don't know how the times will exactly work. Maybe it only had time to create an extra two threads and then kick off the fifth piece of work. Here it's got the time to first byte down to 200 milliseconds. Well, that's pretty interesting. It's kind of weird, though, isn't it? And the thing to note about the thread pool and the task parallel library is that when it's feeling out what is the optimum number of threads to be running, it does so only gradually. Like sometimes it might even take up to 1 second to allocate the new thread. So if you're doing this, maybe it took longer than 200 milliseconds because it just took too long to allocate those extra threads. Let's draw the ideal timeline diagram for what I wish the code would do. A request comes in, the user hits the refresh button. I want it to kick off all of the requests to the database in parallel. That makes sense. The database is the best person in the world to know how to do its magic, to figure out how to hit the database best to handle the requests. I hit all of them off in parallel. I assume the database will probably optimize them so it can do them fairly quickly. Afterwards, the results will trickle in. They might come in out of order. They might come in 90 milliseconds, 110 milliseconds from after I kick them off. It doesn't matter. I'll get them all out. I'll probably get the result back in 100 milliseconds, 110 milliseconds. I will have the absolute fastest time to first byte here. I will have the happiest users of my website. So what have we got through? The principles. I said it was so crucial to distinguish CPU-bound work from I/O-bound work. What do I mean? What is CPU-bound work? CPU-bound work means things like link over objects, big data sets, big iterations. That's CPU-bound. Computational inner loops are more, again, CPU-bound. Parallel.forEach and task.run are a good way to put CPU-bound work onto the thread pool, to use as many cores as possible to make the user interface more responsive. And the thread pool will gradually feel out how many threads will be optimal to use. I have to be clear, though, that the use of threads from the thread pool will never increase the throughput on a server that's under load. By throughput, we mean how many requests per second, what volume of traffic can it handle? Because let's suppose it's dealing with 20 requests simultaneously. If one of the requests now tries to branch out and use five threads, that means that my machine on the server now is taking five times as many threads to handle all of the requests in parallel. And if threads were the bottleneck on it, I've now made the bottleneck much worse on this machine. Creating additional threads to handle requests in ASP will never increase its throughput under load. So for I/O bound work, we should be using a weight rather than background threads. For CPU bound work, we can consider using task.run or parallel.forEach to put it onto background threads if we're doing a user interface app or if our server is not heavily under load. But if we're worried about scalability, then using those parallel techniques will not help. And one other important thing is that when we're writing libraries, I'll be talking about this library writing a lot more tomorrow. If we're writing libraries, our libraries should not be creating additional threads. Our libraries should leave the user of our libraries to be the person who decides how many threads they want to use and when and why. Well, let's see that in practice. This is what the user with his housing application on the website should have written. He should have done an async method returning a task of list of house. Then it goes through all of the houses he needs and it just kicks off a database load on each of them, kicks it off, and assigns the resulting task into a list. At the end, it can await task.whenAll of all of those outstanding tasks, get back an array of the answers, and return that as a list. That's brilliant. Well, that was for I/O bound work. I wanted to show you a bit of work based on some. I wanted to show you some work that was CPU bound and talk about best practices around here. I have to confess, this is the only piece of code in the entire talk that did not come from users. The reason is, I was looking for CPU bound work out on the forums. Very few people are writing CPU bound work out there for some reason. So I had to invent something. What this is was doing financial analysis for options trading. The way it works when they're doing options analysis is they simulate a million different ways that the market might go. And this graph shows all the different ways of where the stocks might go up or down. A million different ways, all equally likely. It simulates all of them. It does a calculation of how well its particular stock option would have performed under all of those million different scenarios. So they're in this loop doing a million of them, simulate a possible stock price history, calculate how much the option would have paid. That's the total payout that one would have done. And then average them out over every single one of the simulations. That's clearly CPU-bound work. In this one, I implemented the analytics in F#. Why did I do that? Because F# is just the natural language for doing computational data analytics. It's why the financial companies of the world are moving to F# for the back end of their code, or the big data number crunchers are using F#, just because the rocket scientists, the mathematicians, can write F# quicker, more correctly, fewer bugs, and F# interops perfectly with C# and VB for the UI front end. So I think F# for this kind of niche is something we'll be seeing more and more of. Anyway, don't worry about that. This is the code I wanted to do. I'm clicking it off in response to a button click handler. It's an async void because it's an event handler. But it's CPU bound work, and because it's CPU bound work on the user's desktop, I really did want to use all of the cores at my disposal to make it run quicker. So how am I going to do that? I'm going to use task.run. That's my general technique, or parallel.forEach, but I'm using task.run here. That's my general technique for pushing CPU-bound work onto a background thread. It's doing exactly the same code as before to run all of them. And then it returns one answer at the end, which is the the average payout, which is total divided by a million, and it binds that to the user interface. What we've seen here is best practice in using background threads. And the best practice is that when you've got code that's got CPU-bound stuff, so often, that's just a small kernel of your code, a very small part of it that's CPU-bound, and the rest of it is just orchestration or GUMP for user interface. Like, we update the user interface, we download the data, then we have the small computational kernel which spits out its result at the end, and then we update the UI based on that. So if we use task.run to narrow it down just to that small computational kernel that spits the answer out at the end, then the way we're getting the answer back is through this var expect power equals await task.run, which picks up what was got back from the return statement. And so this task.run thing does nothing on the UI. And that works for like 90% of the CPU-bound code that we're doing. If it doesn't work, let's suppose the user wanted some feedback about how the progress is going. In this case, the new type that we've introduced in .NET 4.5 to help with this is a type called iProgress, a new interface, and a concrete type called progress. So what we're going to do is create one of these progress types with the callback that will be invoked whenever the progress has changed. So we do the background thread work. And remember, most of the time, the background thread is unable to update the UI directly. So instead, it's going to update the UI by invoking a method on that iProgress interface that it got back, iProgress.report. So what's going to happen is the way that this concrete progress type works is whenever it receives a report, even from background thread, it will marshal to the UI thread, or at least it will marshal to the thread it was on when it was constructed in the first place. It will marshal back to the thread, and then it will execute the lambda. And in that way, this is how we're going to report progress from a long-running piece of work. Well, that's it. There's some more stuff to talk about here. I said that we can't update the UI from a background thread in general. That's true for Windows 8, Windows Phone, Silverlight. It's not true for WPF. In WPF, data-bound properties, you can update them from the background thread, and they will automatically do this marshalling to the UI thread without the progress type. And new in .NET 4.5, if you have collections that are data-bound to the UI, you can update the collection from the background thread, and it will automatically marshal to the UI. Anyway, that doesn't apply to modern client development, unfortunately. And I don't think the Windows or the phone teams are in any danger of adding that kind of stuff soon. Key patterns to recognize. When the code looks async, but it isn't really. When the user thought he was using parallel.foreach in a good way, but he wasn't really using it in a correct way. The key thing there is that we're going to look to see, do we think it's CPU bound or IO bound? And when he was using parallel.for, was he really using it in an asynchronous way, meaning it returns a task that is signaled when it's completed, or was he using it in a synchronous way? And there are a couple of warning signs here that if you download the full deck, it'll highlight what are the warning signs to look for when it's being misused. There's one other kind of sneaky thing. In a Windows 8 application, sometimes there are hidden CPU costs that you won't expect to happen. Like if I kicked off 500 tasks from my UI thread, then when they finish, each of them will take 2 milliseconds or so. So that was kind of unexpected. There are hidden costs in Windows 8 async, and the slides have more details on them. But without getting to them, I want to go back to what we've talked about. Most importantly, we talked about how important it is to look at code and think, is that CPU bound or IO bound? If it's IO bound, we're going to use await, and it's going to be truly task and asynchronous based all the way through using awaits. If it was CPU bound, that's when we're going to use things, if it was CPU bound on the client, that's when we're going to use task.run or parallel.for each to leverage the background CPUs without harming user interface responsiveness. We talked about how the thread pool will gradually feel out how many threads are optimum, but it will take time to do that. And remember, using extra threads will never improve throughput on your Azure node or your ASP page if it's under load. Never. It's kind of interesting. I mean, that about ties everything up. There's a thread that I wanted to talk about with async, and that is thread creation. There's nothing. If you think back to the initial diagram I drew with the dot that moved around, there was nothing in that code, even though it had async and await in it, there was nothing in that code that created extra threads. Nothing in the C# or VB languages will implicitly create extra threads. That was really important for us. We think threads are a resource that you should be explicitly managing yourself. Usually, you should be leaving it to the top level to explicitly manage how many threads they want, because it's a precious resource. Only at the top level can they decide how best to use them. And that's why the decision to use task.run or parallel.forEach should not be made inside a library. It should be made at the top level. There are 7.5 minutes left to this talk. I could stop for questions, and I am going to stop for questions, but they're not going to be your questions, they're going to be my questions. This is still early enough in the morning that you can think about it. Looking through the forums, figuring out what are the common problems that people have. Everything here will just be a kind of reminder of lessons that we've learned through this, common problems to avoid, common tips in async. People say, hey, my code isn't running asynchronously. Look, here's my code in the button click handler. I did this action work equals CPU work, and then I awaited schedule work of work. This is the async method that schedules the work. It takes in an action and it does the work. And they say, hey, this code is blocking my CPU. It's making my UI unresponsive, even though I put the async modifier. What's up with that? Can you tell me what's wrong with this? Yeah, you can. Put your hands up and shout out. Yeah. Exactly. Async without await. There's nothing in async that creates background threads. All of this was doing was simply running it on the thread that it was called. So it was doing no benefit at all. The problem was thinking that async forks a background thread, and it doesn't. And the solution is to use task.run. Whenever he wanted to use task.run, whenever he wanted to use a background thread. Another problem. He said, hey, my code is completed too quickly. I put this call to task.delay of 1,000, but even though it was task.delay of 1,000, code continued immediately after this statement. What's wrong here? Anyone? Yeah, await. Just missed out the await statement. So whenever you've got an awaitable, await it. It seems obvious. Most of the time, the compiler will warn you. Like if you have a method that was declared with the async modifier in your own code and you invoke it, it will warn you. If you're inside a method with the async modifier and you call something without awaiting it, it will warn you. We unfortunately couldn't add the warning in all situations because it would have broken backwards compatibility. But you can watch out for that, and it's easy to recognize. This one's more difficult. This calls back to the first section of my talk. What's wrong here? Or at least, when you look at this code, which of your warning bells start ringing? Lambda. You said, look, there's a lambda with an async that fires my warning bells. I need to look at the definition of parallel.for to see, does it just take a void returning action delegate or does it take a task returning func delegate? In this case, let's look at it. It only takes an action delegate, so we know that this code is not going to do what we expected. So the solution really, I should have just been creating tasks and doing await task.whenAll on them rather than parallel.for. So, I mean, the lesson is use extreme caution whenever you see an async lambda. Here's another one. Await task.factory.startNew with an async lambda in here. And we're trying to await until the task we've got back has finished. What's wrong with this? Exactly the same thing. It's an async lambda. Warning bells fire off. Start new. Although it takes a func, of t result. It's not really task aware. Although this happens to return a task, it's not returning a task in the sense that we want it to. It's not a return statement that returns a task. It's returning a task because it's an async method. And the start new overload is not aware of that thing. In fact, what it's going to produce is a task of task when it returns. Or if I'd had a return three statement, it would have got back a task of integer, not the task of integer that we probably wanted. So the thing is, we should have used task.run here, which explicitly handles this case. Task.run, as I said at the beginning, has multiple overloads, which helps you. Method not completing. This, if you remember the diagram of control flow that I showed you at the beginning of the talk, you can look at this and figure out by walking through what the bug is. The problem is that he set a breakpoint on the closing brace and he never got to it. He actually set a breakpoint on this closing brace and it never got to it. What he said is, hey, my await is never completing. Why isn't it completing? This one is a bit difficult. The reason it's not completing is we've got that little green ping pong ball moving around. And the ping pong ball is moving around and it's got to this statement here, foo async.wait. This is a blocking call to wait until the task is finished. So the ping pong ball, when it returns from the creating the task here, when it returns from the first await here, it's then going to be stuck. The ping pong ball is not able to move any further. So that even though the await finishes, and even though it says, hey, please UI thread when you're free, can you schedule the rest of my method to complete? It never gets complete because the UI thread is never free to schedule it. So the problem that we've got here is deadlocking the UI thread. And the solution is don't synchronously wait on the UI thread. Don't use task.wait or task.result on the UI thread. Those are guaranteed to lead to deadlocks. Whenever I see, hey, my await isn't completing, 99.9% of the time, this is the problem. And the solution is the top level should have awaited it. That would have worked. There's one other workaround. The library author, I'll talk more about this tomorrow, the library author could have done this thing called configure await to defend himself even if the user had called a blocking API wrongly, but that's bad practice and isn't the best way to solve the problem. One final question. Remember when I did the task completion source and I did everything inside, or I unhooked the lambda inside the finally block because it was so important to unhook it? This has a kind of similar problem. The user had this code and he said, look, my code works most of the time, but sometimes when I await the task that comes back, it never completes. What might have happened here? Can anyone tell me what happened? What happened? Let's think it through. If this foo method threw an exception. Yeah, you're nodding your heads now. Obvious. You just wanted to say it in front of everyone in case it wasn't the right answer. If foo throws an exception, then we will never get to this statement and we will never change the state of the task. Remember, a task can be in one of two states, either not yet completed or completed. And if it threw an exception in this code, it will never transition to the completed state. And so the solution is you have to make sure that you are always creating a task completion source when you complete it, using a finally block. And so I'd rewrite it like this, with a try, a catch statement, and if there was an exception, I will store it inside the task completion source. And what that does is that anyone who was awaiting the task that I gave back, when they await, when they resume after their await, then this exception will be rethrown for them. That's the end of my talk. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to be here for questions. I'll be at the Ask the Experts table tomorrow if you want to chat more about async. I'm giving the talk tomorrow, as I said, which delves deeper into the more library issues and how we deal with that, and how we deal with integrating async into a large program that's not been architected with async from the ground up. Just before I go, please do fill out the evaluation forms. That's what we speakers live or die for. Thank you very much.